From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we remember the songwriter Johnny Cash described as his favorite, Billy Joe Shaver.
I'm just an old chunk of coal, but I'm gonna be a diamond someday.
His songs have been performed by Cash, Kris Kristofferson, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan, and Elvis Presley. Shaver first became known as the songwriter for the country music outlaws of the 70s. He died Wednesday at the age of 81. We'll listen back to two of Terry's interviews with him. Also, Justin Chang reviews City Hall, the latest documentary by the 90-year-old filmmaker Frederick Wiseman.
I'm gonna be a diamond someday.
Country music songwriter and performer Billy Joe Shaver died Wednesday in Waco, Texas, after suffering a stroke. He was 81. Shaver's music was recorded by Johnny Cash, who described him as his favorite songwriter, as well as by Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Bob Dylan, and Elvis Presley. In the 70s, Shaver's songs were an essential part of country music's outlaw movement, which broke out of the slick Nashville style. Shaver wrote all but one song on Waylon Jennings' 1973 breakthrough album Honky Tonk Heroes. He recorded several albums of his own and for years performed with his son, guitarist Eddie Shaver. Eddie Shaver died in 2000, but Billy Joe soldiered on and performed as recently as this January. He lived a life as colorful as the songs he wrote. He grew up poor in Texas, abandoned by an abusive father, lost two fingers in a sawmill accident at age 21, was tried for shooting a man outside a bar, and acquitted after character testimony from Willie Nelson and Robert Duvall, and he married the same woman three times. He also struggled with alcohol and drugs before he found Jesus. In 2004, he was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. Today we're going to listen to parts of two interviews he recorded with Terry. The first was in 1994, when he'd released a new album called Tramp on Your Street. They began by listening to a song from the record. This is Georgia on a Fast Train.
On a rainy, windy morning, that's the day I was born in that old sharecropper's one-room country shack. They say my mammy left me, same day that she had me, said she hit the road and never once looked back. And that's what I'd mention. My grandma's old age pension is the reason why I'm standing here today. I got all my country learning, milking and a churning, digging cotton, raising, hailing, baling hay. I've been to Georgia on a fast train, honey. I wasn't born no yesterday. Got a good Christian raising and a 8th grade education. Ain't no needin' y'all to treat me this way.
Billy Joe Shaver, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
You're better known as a songwriter than a singer. Do you enjoy performing and do you enjoy doing your own songs?
Yes, I do. I can't imagine how it would be to do other people's songs because it's such a wonderful thing to be able to do your own tunes. You get to catch that little capsule of time that you invented there and you get to step into it for that moment.
Now, from what I understand from your songs, you didn't start performing until after years of working jobs, of doing manual labor.
Yes, I actually had an accident in a sawmill, and I had to pull off my two fingers on this right hand, and then another one got the end of it knocked off, and the little finger got kind of banged up, but I still got a good thumb on that hand, that's what happened to me, and then I decided I would start writing songs and playing the guitar after that.
So you sawed off your fingers at an accident in a sawmill?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How did you end up playing guitar after that?
I was about 28 years old then, and it hit me that I should be doing what I'm supposed to do, because I'd been writing all that time since I was a little kid. I'd been singing and stuff, and I just never had got serious with the guitar yet, and so When this happened, right at the very moment it happened, it just hit me right in the heart that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. I guess if I hadn't had these things cut off, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. But anyway, something has to kind of hit me over the head before I figure it out. But The reason I started playing guitar, I guess, is it was the hardest thing for me to do. Two, and my arm was in bad shape. They had to put electrodes on it to make it start moving again. It swelled up, almost lost it. And playing the guitar helped it, you know.
No, so it's your right hand that you set your fingers on?
Yeah.
So what do you do? Like
I fret with my left hand and just whack away at it with my right.
Do you use a pick?
No, I don't. I just use my fingers and my thumb and my little finger. So, I'm not a great guitar player, but I play good enough that I can write songs and play in front of people, so it's no big deal.
So once you decided that you weren't doing what you were supposed to be doing, what you should be doing is playing music and writing songs, what did you do to start off on that new life?
I just started doing it. I just started writing songs, and I got me some good songs together, and I went up to Nashville. And then about in 71 or so, Bobby put out a song that I wrote, Ride Me Down Easy, and it went number one country. And then Waylon Jennings did a whole album of songs called Honky Tonk Heroes. And Johnny Rodriguez had a hit on one called I Couldn't Be Me Without You. And then Old Chunk of Coal, John Anderson had a hit with. And Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, Kris Kristofferson, Tom T. Hall, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, people just started recording my tunes.
Which song did Elvis do?
Elvis did one called Just Because You Asked Me To. It's a song that Waylon and I wrote together.
Can you sing a couple of bars of that?
Long ago and far away, in my old common labor shoes, I turned the world all which ways just because you asked me to. Anyway, the chorus is, let the world call me a fool, but if things are right with me and you, that's all that matters, and I'll do anything you ask me to.
I want to play something else from your new album, Tramp on Your Street. I want to play the song, If I Give My Soul, which I think might be my favorite on the record. And this is a song wondering if you gave your soul to Jesus, would your life change and would your family love you more? Let me play this song, and then I'll ask you about writing it.
Okay. I had a woman once. She was kind and she was gentle. Had a child by me who grew up to be. I had a steady job till I started into drinking. Then I started making music, traveling with the devil's band. Oh, the years flew by like a mighty rush of eagles. My dreams and plans were all scattered.
Billy Joe Shaver from his new album, Tramp on Your Street, and he wrote that song. It's called If I Give My Soul. The son that you're singing about, who you left in that song, is that your son Eddie who plays guitar with you now?
Yes, that's my only child. Yeah, he lost a lot of respect for me because of the things that I was doing in this business. And I won't say in this business, I mean it's just the things that I got caught up in. Like a lot of other people, but...
What kinds of things?
Well, you know, alcohol, drugs, running around. Just, I was, I guess, the king of sinners, as far as I was concerned. But I got myself straightened out, and it was with the Lord Jesus Christ. That's how I got myself straightened out. Now, I don't know how other people do it, to each his own, but that's how I done it.
So you did give your soul?
Yes, I did.
What was the turning point for you of deciding to change?
Oh, what really happened was it happened when I wrote the song Old Chunk of Coal. I actually had a vision of Jesus sitting on the end of my bed, shaking his head. And I went out to a place out at the narrows of the Harpeth River. That's a cliff up on top. And there's like altars that are the wind, rain, or something, hewing them out up there. There's one big one, and it's right on the edge of the cliff. And for some reason or another, I drove out there in the middle of the night and went up that path, which is pretty treacherous anyway. And I got up there and decided that I was either going to end it or whatever was going to happen with me. And I found myself on my knees right there at the edge of that cliff with and my head down in my hands and asking the Lord to forgive me and God to forgive me and for the Lord to help me. And I hadn't written a song in a long time. And I remember I was having a hard time just putting a sentence together. I was so messed up. But we were making money then. So I was able to keep going, you know, and keep supplying myself with the things that were killing me. But I went ahead and asked God to help me, and a lot of things went on up there. It'd be too long to go into, but I came down the trail singing this song, Old Chunk of Coal. And I, the whole first part of the song, whole first half of the song, by the time I got down to the end of the trail, was written. And then it took me about 6 more months, and I wrote the other part.
You sing Old Chunk of Coal on your new CD, so why don't we hear a little bit of that? And this is Billy Joe Shaver.
I'm just an old chunk of coal, but I'm gonna be a diamond someday. Now I'm gonna grow and glow till I'm so blue, perfect. Gonna put a smile on everybody's face. I'm gonna kneel and pray every day, lest I should become vain along the way. I'm just an old chunk of coal now, Lord, but I'm gonna be a diamond someday.
So you wrote Old Chunk of Coal after...
That was back many years back.
Yeah.
But it took a long time to get back the respect of the people that I loved.
Uh-huh. Did you get back to your family after?
Well, no, really. We were divorced the last time in 1986, and I'm not back with her, no. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everything happens for the best, I think. But my son's with me and playing with me, and he'll stay with me until I get my feet on the ground with this thing, and... Then I mean he'll fly away.
And then what? Then he'll fly away?
Yeah, he'll fly away and do his own thing.
So you think that he's playing with you to help you out through this period?
Yes, I am. I'm sure of that, yeah.
Did he know your songs when, even in that period when he was angry with you and mm-hmm. you weren't close, do you think your music still had an impact on him?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm probably the one that has more trouble with forgiving myself than other people do, but I finally did.
Billy Joe Shaver speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
On the next episode of Louder Than a Riot, how a law meant to control the mob changed the mixtape game forever.
Gangsta Grillz is the biggest thing arguably ever in the mixtape's history. Don't tell me that what we're doing is wrong.
Listen now to Louder Than a Riot, the podcast from NPR Music.
Let's get back to Terry's 1994 interview with Billy Joe Shaver. He died Wednesday at the age of 81. She asked him where he grew up.
I was born in Corsicana, Texas, and it's about 53 miles northeast of Waco, Texas. And I lived there until I was 12 years old. My grandmother raised me, and she passed on when I was 12, and I went to Waco, Texas, and lived with my mother. And she had married a Bohemian fellow up there, and I stayed there with them until I went in the Navy, and I went in the Navy when I was 16, so.
The song says your mother left when you were born.
Yeah, I know on the one on George on the Fast Train, or no, George on the Fast Train, it says they say my mammy left me the same day that she had me.
Yeah, is it true?
Well, not really. Her and my father, I didn't meet my father until I was nearly grown, but my father beat her up pretty bad and kicked her around and everything, and even when I was inside of her, and so she went to get work, actually, is what happened. She had to go to Waco and went to work in a honky-tonk so that she could send money back to my grandmother and raise us.
What did she do at the honky-tonk?
She was a honky-tonk girl. She just a waitress-type person, her and this old gal named Blanche. They run that place I refer to as the Green Gables in Honky Tonk Heroes. Of course, mm-hmm. I don't have a cut of that, but that's where that song came from.
Did you ever get close to your mother in later life?
Yes, I did. And as a matter of fact, my mother's name is Victory. That's her real name. And she and I are just as close as you can get. I love her very much, and she did a lot of sacrifices for me and my sister. I have one sister. And I love my father also. He's passed away, but I love him too.
So tell me something about your early musical life.
Oh, when I was just a kid, from the time that I remember I started talking, I was singing. And we didn't have a radio. My grandmother lived with her. But I would every once in a while hear one, you know, and I'd hear somebody singing this and that. And I would just go ahead and sing that part of it and just make the rest of it up myself and pat my foot. No guitar or anything, just pat my foot and sing. I was just a little kid, and people liked to hear me. And I remember my grandmother, she had credit down at the general store down the road, and sometime her old age pension check wouldn't come in. And we'd go down there and get an extension on credit, and she would ask the lady if she could get an extension on credit. And the lady knew that I sang, and she said, well, yeah, if you stand that boy up on that Cracker Barrel there and let him sing a tune or two, I'll let you have it, you know. And I thought I was really singing for my supper, so I sang my heart out.
What kind of songs would you sing?
I'd sing like some Roy Acuff type things, and Pins and Needles in My Heart and stuff like that.
Now, how much sense do these songs make to a six-year-old?
not very much, but I started writing my own songs.
When you were that young?
Yes, I did. I would write about what was going down with me.
Like what?
Oh, I can't remember exactly everything. Most of them was kind of funny.
You know what I wanted to ask you? This gets back to your accident when you sawed off your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you remember what your very first thought was when you realized you'd sawed your fingers off?
Yeah. I said, oh, my God. How am I going to do what I'm really supposed to do now? And I just kicked myself in the ass, you know, for being so clumsy and cutting my, you know, and causing my fingers to, I just really, really got after myself about it, because I knew ahead of time what I was supposed to be doing, but I just kept pushing it away.
Did you take your fingers with you to the hospital?
Yes, I did. I scooped them up out of the sawdust there, and I went and got in my pickup, and I drove over to the doctor's office. We had a company doctor. And he was an old Navy doctor. His name was Tab. And that was in Waco. William Cameron was the place where I was working. And I brought the fingers up to him, and he said, hey, boy, he said, you got some trouble there, don't you? I said, yeah, I sure do. I said, I'd like for you to sew these fingers back on. He said, well, I never heard of such. He said, you can't sew fingers back. I said, well, I told him, I said, you know, I'd read this article about these Japanese people sewing fingers and stuff back on. And then, of course, he reminded me we were in Waco, Texas, and that wasn't going to work.
Did people tell you that it wouldn't be possible for you to play guitar and that it was foolish to even try?
No, nobody messed with me on that. I was lucky that I didn't, they were talking about even cutting my arm off. I was lucky that I got to keep my arm.
Did you have to try to talk the doctors out of cutting your arm
off?
Yes,
I did.
Mm-hmm. How did you?
I told them that it wasn't going to happen.
Well, there's a song I want to end with, and it's called Live Forever. Would you tell us something about the song?
Yes. My son, Eddie, gave me this melody, and I carried it around with me for about 6 months, I guess. And I would listen to it and try to figure out what was going to come in to fill that melody up. It's such a wonderful melody. And finally this came across, the words and came into the melody, and then Eddie helped me a little bit with the words again too, and so he and I wrote this together. And it pretty much says how I feel about the whole thing.
It's a great song.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Billy Joe Shaver recorded in 1994. He died Wednesday at the age of 81. After a break, we'll hear Terry's 2005 interview with him. Here's Billy Joe Shaver with his son Eddie in their song Live Forever. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
One, two. I'm gonna live forever, I'm gonna cross that river, I'm gonna catch tomorrow night. You're gonna wanna hold me, just like I always told you, you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Nobody here will ever find me, but I will always be around. Just like the songs I leave behind me, I'm gonna live forever now.
In this election, most of the country already has their mind made up. Whether President Trump or Joe Biden wins this November will be decided by a small group of undecided voters. Find out what could get them off the fence every day on the NPR Politics podcast.
We're listening back to Terry's interviews with country music's Billy Joe Shaver, who died Wednesday at the age of 81. Shaver's songs were recorded by Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Bob Dylan, and Elvis Presley. He recorded several albums of his own and for years performed with his son, guitarist Eddie Shaver, who died in 2000 of a drug overdose. Just about a year earlier, Billy Joe Shaver lost his mother and his wife to cancer. Terry spoke to Shaver in 2005 when he'd published his memoir. They began by listening to his song, Hearts A-Bustin'.
Hearts a-bustin' grew down by the river that flows by the old paper mill. In the springtime we stood there together at the top of the old stone Ford Hill. Many's a time I've been lonesome since you left. I don't know what to do. Like a flower that grows on the hillside, my heart's a-bustin' for you.
I'd like you to tell us the story behind the song. I assume you wrote this for your wife, who died in 1999 of cancer. Was she alive when you wrote it?
You know, that's a real old song.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And the strange thing about it is that I wrote it and I hid it from her because she'd had to be dead, you know? And somehow or another, I knew she was going to die before I did. And I wrote this song about this little lily. I guess it's in the lily family. I don't know much about flowers either. I'm a redneck. And this one, though, is it looks like a little, it has the petals coming out, and it's a little booger, and it's just as white as it can be, white as snow, but on the inside of it is a petal that looks like a heart, but it's broken. It's broken kind of almost half in two, and it just looks like blood red. It just looks like it's bleeding, you know? And I don't know the correct name for that flower, but the hillbillies and stuff around there call it a hearts a-bustin'. And that's where I got the idea for the song.
Your wife, for whom that song was written, died in 1999. I know you'd separated several times over the years.
Yes.
You were married three times.
Married three times, yeah.
The last time you were married, she had cancer. She had colon cancer. Did you know that this time it was forever, that you'd stay
together?
Yeah,
I knew.
To the end?
I knew I was doing a movie. Oh, I was doing The Apostle. I met Robert Duvall, and then about 10 years later, they called up. He didn't call me, but they called me up for a screen test to come down here to Austin. I live in Waco, and come down to Austin, do a little screen test and see if you got what it takes to do this part. So I did, and it wasn't that hard. And I went down to Louisiana, Lafayette, Louisiana. Anyway, I called my wife because he put me in a presidential suite, which actually I asked the bellhop. I said, man, is this the right place? Because I didn't even set my bags down. It was a huge place. It had big old tables and TVs. Oh, well, anyway. I didn't have nobody to share it with, so I called Brenda up. She's living with some convict then. She thought she was in love, I guess. Maybe she was. And I finally convinced her to drive to Lafayette. And she got in her truck and drove. She had one of them little minivans, and she drove all the way. And when she got there, she was like, I'd never seen her before. She was real blowed up, you know, and real tired. She went directly to bed, and Johnny Cash and them came while we were filming and stuff, and she still didn't get out of bed. She just stayed in that bed for 3 days. And I knew something was wrong with her. And when I got done, I just got with her, and I took her right straight to the doctor. And she had advanced rectal cancer. And then we took her over, and she had surgery and all kinds of things, chemo. She went through all that stuff. I stayed with her. It was almost 3.5 years, and I got to do a lot of things for her that she didn't, you know, that she had done for me. We bonded so hard on that last trip there that, I don't know, I just fell back in love with her again. I just never had died, and when she passed, it was terrible. I mean, it wasn't terrible. I was happy for her because she was in such pain, but it wasn't long after that my son passed, but my mother had passed about 3 months before that. And my mother-in-law had passed about 3 months before that. So there was a lot of dying going on, and it comes in threes like that. I don't know, I was real happy for her in a way, and then Eddie, he never got over it.
Your son?
Yeah, he just never got over it.
Yeah, you've said that your son and your wife were so close in age. She was 17.
Yeah.
When
your
son
turned
was
17.
Born.
She was.
You said they were more like friends than parents.
They were.
Son.
They were so cool, man. They went everywhere. They just had so much fun. And all his wives were jealous of her, you know, I mean, because they just had so much fun together. But they just run, did everything. And he was a great guy, and she was a great girl.
Your wife died in 1999, and your son at the end of the following year. What was the next year like for you, having lost both of them and your mother as well?
Well, it was very lonesome, but I had my dogs that she left me. She left me two pit bulls, and one of them was older, and the one that's with me now, she finally passed away. But if I hadn't had them dogs, I don't know what I'd done, because they kept me going, because I had to feed them and get up and go. And Willie Nelson, I got to give him credit. He's the one that talked me back out into the world. He said, come on, Billy. He said, you're supposed to play tonight. It's New Year's night. And Willie said, I'll throw something together. And Willie sat up there and played all night long. And I'd go up and sing every once in a while.
I owe Willie a lot. He's been such a good friend.
But you say this was New Year's Eve. Was it actually the night that your son died, or a year after that?
Yeah, he died. He died that night, New Year's Eve. He died on New Year's Eve.
And so that night you performed with Willie Nelson, he convinced you to perform?
Yeah. He said, get back on the horse. And I'm a cowboy, so I did. And then I just went on and worked from then on. I just kept on doing working. We had lots and lots of work, so I just kept on working.
You actually had a heart attack on stage in August mm-hmm. of 2001, and then you had quadruple bypass. I was thinking about what it must be like to have a heart attack on stage and in front of an audience. How bizarre and kind of creepy. Do you have memories of that?
Well, yeah, it was like an elephant on my chest, but I was at the Green Hall, and you know, I really wanted to die. I don't know. A lot of people say, nah, you don't really, but you do. When things like that happen to you. And I was so thankful. I said, God, thank you so much for letting me die in the oldest honky-tonk in Texas. But I had these doggone nitro, because I couldn't hardly sing without it. I'd chunk these nitros, but I'd washed them the night before in my pants, and they were real crumbly, you know. And I would hit them as my, you know, I'd hit them pretty regularly, as a matter of fact. I put in it, stuck the whole bottle. And I was able to sing. I just kept singing. And Jesse Taylor, when he was young, he was in a car accident, and he lost hearing in one of his ears. And it happened to be the ear that was next to me. And I kept telling him, just one more. And he thought I meant, you know, I said, this is the last one. And he thought I meant one more. And he just kept playing. And the audience was so around us, they were just like, it was like hot there because they don't have any air conditioning. Hardwood floors, they just open these flaps, you know, and it's still like it always was. But just kept on playing. And meanwhile, I'm just dying, and I'm taking this nitro. And then afterwards, I had to sign all these things, and I'm still trying to die, you know. Doggone, I didn't die. I was real upset about that because that was the oldest honky-tonk in Texas, and I thought it would be great to die there. And then the next night, I had to go to Pflugerville, of all places. You can't hardly even pronounce it, much less spell it. And at Hanover's and play there. And I'd got me another motel room. I laid down, and I still going through this thing, you know. And it'd come in waves then. It kind of gave me a little relief every once in a while. And then I decided, well, I'll go play this, and I'll die here. It's awful to die in Pflugerville, but I will. And the lady that runs my business, T-shirts and stuff, Diane Chain, she came by. She said, Billy, you're going to the hospital. And I said, no, I ain't. And she finally talked me into it. And we drove all the way back to Waco, and they took me in there and checked me out. Sure enough, I had 10% blood flow and blowed all my arteries out. They went and put stents in that one so I could get some blood. But I was supposed to go on this tour with Kinky over to Australia. Kinky Friedman, my friend. And it was a 3-week tour. And I called him. I said, Kinky, I had a heart attack. I got to get this bypass. And he said, hey, people have heart attacks every day. He said, you're going to ruin my career. And I said, what? He said, yeah, you got to go with me. And so he talked me into going to Australia. 3 weeks of teetotal hell. I just wanted to kill him. And finally I got back and the doctors were mad. Oh. And did a 4-way bypass on me. I got 5. I'm running on 5, really. So
you ended up having bypass and...
Yes, I did, after I come back from an Australian trip.
Are you glad that you survived? Sounded like you almost wanted to die.
I did. I kept wanting to die. I kept wanting to die, you know, because it just didn't look like as much for me. But then I realized there's lots and lots of people cared about me. And cared about what I was doing. They started listening to the songs a little more now. You know, deaths seem like they bring that around or something.
Do you feel like your songwriting has changed in the past few years after all the losses you've experienced and the health crisis of your own? Has that had an impact on your songwriting?
I haven't noticed it if it has. I just hurt so hard to do quality work. And that's what I've stayed with, and I believe that's why Cream finally comes to the top. Not to, I'd just be beyond me to be humble. I'd have to be acting humble if I was to be humble. I'm humble in a way, but I'm thankful more than anything that somebody finally started listening.
I guess it's in your memoir that you wrote that Johnny Cash, who was a long time friend of yours, mm-hmm. said that when he was in rehab, he used to, every morning, he'd sing to himself your song, Old Chunk of Coal, which is a song about somebody who feels like an old chunk of coal, but hopes to become mm-hmm. a diamond one day. Mm-hmm. And I thought, there is no higher compliment a songwriter can have than that a song meant so much that, like, Johnny Cash would have sung it to himself to give himself strength every morning.
Oh, I had to hung up when I started crying. You know, I'll still cry from time to time. Not in front of anybody, but I started crying. It just was the greatest compliment, and I just still love him so much.
You say in your memoir that you read the Bible every day.
Yeah, I do. Try to. Down here lately, I haven't actually. I missed it a day or two.
So do you think your songs have been influenced by reading the Bible?
Oh, yeah, sure.
How?
Yeah. Jesus Christ is he's the one who made us all number two. And I always say, if you don't love Jesus, go to hell. But may the God of your choice bless you also.
It's very charitable.
Yeah, I'm a giving man.
Billy Joe Shaver, would you like to play a song for us to close?
Yes, I would. I'd like to do Try and Try Again. Saved my life. I went up on the mountain and I looked down on my life. I had squandered all my money, lost my son and wife. And my heart was filled with sorrow and I almost took my life. But I found the strength inside me to give life one more try. And if at first you don't succeed, just try and try again. And if at first you don't succeed, well, try and try again. And if all you would do is lose, you'd better find a way to win. If at first you don't succeed, try and try again. Well, I know someday the world will learn to sing a better song. The lame will walk, the mute will talk, we all will sing along. The fighting will be ended and all hunger will be gone. It's everybody's business till we get the good work done. And if at first you don't succeed, just try and try again. And if at first you don't succeed, well, try and try again. And if all you do is lose, you better find a way to win. If at first you don't succeed, well, try and try again. And if at first you don't succeed, just try and try and try again. If at first you don't succeed, try and try again. And if all you do is lose, you'd better find a way to win. If at first you don't succeed, well, try and try again. I know someday, the deaf man's gonna hear the blind man's song. And someday the whole world gonna grow new eyes to see and new ears to hear. We're all gonna sing along. And our point of view is gonna grow into a pure and perfect one. And the voice of truth inside us all gonna help us sing that song. If at first you don't succeed, brother, sister, try and try and try again. Amen and amen. You got to keep trying, folks. Just keep trying. Sometimes, if you just keep trying, you can get it done. But you got to keep trying. Try and try again. Amen and amen.
Billy Joe Shaver, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Billy Joe Shaver speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2005. He died Wednesday at the age of 81. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the latest documentary by Frederick Weissman. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Spotify, presenting Dare to Lead. If leadership isn't about corner offices and big fancy titles, what is it about? Join Brené Brown on her new podcast, Dare to Lead, as she talks to leaders at every level about what it takes to show up and step up in all parts of our daily lives. Hear insights from change makers and culture shifters and unpack what it means to lead with courage and vulnerability. Dare to Lead is available only on Spotify. Download the Spotify app for free to listen.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
City Hall, the latest documentary from the prolific Frederick Weissman, is an in-depth 4.5-hour study of the inner workings of Boston City Hall. It's now streaming in virtual cinemas. Our film critic Justin Chang says that its complex but inspiring vision of government in action makes it an ideal movie to watch before or after the upcoming election.
Frederick Weissman's new documentary, City Hall, was shot in 2018 and 2019. Which means that it already plays like a pre-COVID time capsule. I'll admit, I spent at least some of this long and absorbing 4.5-hour film picturing what the 2020 version might look like. A disaster movie, perhaps, about dedicated civil servants frantically trying to help their communities survive unprecedented disruption. And of course, Weissman's signature scenes, the workplace meetings where budgets are broken down and bureaucratic procedures are hammered out, would have been shot as a series of Zoom sessions. I'd probably watch it anyway, such is Weissman's gift for making riveting cinema from the minutiae of the everyday. Still, I'm grateful for the version of City Hall we have before us, a sweeping, panoramic vision, both hopeful and tough-minded, about how local government works and sometimes doesn't work. It's the 45th feature directed by the now 90-year-old Weissman, who has spent more than 6 decades capturing the intimate bustle and flow of life in America's institutions, in films like High School, Hospital, and Ex Libris, the New York Public Library. City Hall is one of the few films Weissman has shot in his hometown, Boston. Not that you'd necessarily know about that connection from the film. While Weissman's style is never impersonal, he avoids familiar documentary techniques like commentary or narration. His camera eavesdrops on meetings, where city employees discuss issues like homelessness, substance abuse, and unemployment, as well as their particular impact on communities of color. He also breaks up the flow by taking us outside those conference rooms. We witness a lesbian couple's wedding, a Chinese New Year celebration, and a Thanksgiving dinner for people with disabilities. These moments are braided together with beautiful shots of Boston's streets and buildings, including the imposing concrete fortress of City Hall itself. Weissman's films don't really have protagonists, but with City Hall, he almost makes an exception. The person we spend the most time with, not surprisingly, is Marty Walsh, the city's Democratic mayor, who at one point seems to be taking us along to every meeting and public appearance on his busy calendar. We see him giving a sobering speech about the city's response to a rash of shootings. A little while later, we see him at Fenway Park, happily celebrating the Red Sox's 2018 World Series victory. In this scene, he informs senior citizens about the resources available to them through the city's Elderly Commission.
All of us, as you get older, you take prescriptions for high blood pressure, for cholesterol, whatever it is you have. And it's important that we understand there's more health risks as you get older because the body breaks down a little bit. So there's more chance that you're going to be on a prescription as you get older. And we need to make sure that that's covered. So The answer is we have to look legislatively at fixing that. One of the reasons why we have the Elderly Commission is to advocate on your behalf. The people that work for the city work for you. They're there to service you. So take advantage of that opportunity. Take advantage of that office. Ask questions. They'll get the answers.
Walsh has an empathetic touch. At one point, addressing some of his Latino constituents, he criticizes the Trump administration's attacks on people of color and reflects on the discrimination endured by past generations of his Irish Catholic family. In another scene, he attends a fundraiser for nurses and reminisces about the kindness of the care he received as a child cancer patient. Sometimes he overreaches in his attempts to relate to his fellow Bostonians, but it's moving to see him make the effort. And he seems genuine in his belief that municipal government can effect real, beneficial change in his citizens' lives. At heart, Wiseman seems to share that conviction. He spent an entire career chronicling the work of individuals and establishments, doggedly trying to make a difference. But he also understands that empathy and good intentions have their limits, especially in a system that often greets serious problems with one-size-fits-all solutions. As much as we see of Mayor Walsh early on, there are lengthy stretches where he's conspicuously absent. We're reminded that he can't be everywhere at once. He's the public face of a government that, like most governments, fails at least as often as it succeeds. The movie's most extraordinary sequence takes place at a public meeting over a cannabis dispensary that is about to open in Dorchester. The store owners, who are Asian American, speak loftily about the economic benefits they'll bring to the community. The residents, many of them black, push back with concerns about traffic, safety, and crime. As the debate continues for several minutes, Wiseman keeps cutting between the two equally defensive sides, showing us just how difficult real communication can be in the face of profound racial and economic differences. Fortunately, not every problem is so intractable. One of my favorite scenes shows two different men trying to get their parking tickets excused, and successfully doing so, with a mix of earnest excuses and humble, open-faced charm. It's a sweet, throwaway scene, but it feels almost utopian in its sense of how government should be, competent, efficient, and deeply human. As City Hall reminds us, our institutions don't always rise to that standard, even at the best of times. They're at once fragile and resilient, and forever in a state of flux. No filmmaker has ever captured that as clearly as Frederick Wiseman, who has become an enduring institution himself.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Frederick Wiseman's new documentary, City Hall, now available at virtual cinemas. You can check the Zipporah Films website for listings. On Monday's show, we speak with Aaron Sorkin. His new Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, dramatizes the infamous Chicago trial of prominent anti-Vietnam War protesters accused of conspiring to start a riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Sorkin sees some parallels between the political divisions of the late 60s and today. I hope you can join us. Halloween is tomorrow, and our staff is looking just a little scarier today. Fresh Air's executioning producer is Dan Eek Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bootham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phil Hiss-Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzombie, Heidi Simonster, Teresa's Madman, and Erie Baldonado, Caldrunner, Seth Skeleton, and Kayla Battimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly Scary Nesbu. Roberta Shriek directed today's show. For Terry, ew, gross, I'm Grave Gravies. Be safe, have fun.